This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 6, Episode 46, Williamson vs. Taylor. Coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, we look at the different techniques between Kane Williamson and Ross Taylor, and then we help a batsman who likes to play like one of them and the other one. We also talk about the difference between overnight success, aha moments, and that long, slow progression that is the most frustrating part of improving your cricket. And we answer a question about a spinner who wants to get a little bit more drift. All that and more coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. Welcome to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. This is your guide to better cricket. It doesn't matter who you are or where you are. If you want to improve your game or improve the game of others, then this is the place to be for the next half an hour or so. There's three of us on the team, and between us, hopefully we can help you out. And the three of us are me, David Hinchliffe, I look after things. And helping me with that are two cricket coaches. The first is the Director of Cricket Coaching at Millfield School. It's Mark Garraway. Hello, Garris, how are you?
Yeah, very good, thank you very much. In the middle of inspections here at Millfield.
Oh, stand by your beds.
An interesting one, but all good.
So you've polished your medals, shined your shoe, made the beds.
Absolutely. Yeah, everybody's on their best behaviour.
Yeah, lovely job. And secondly, it's the cricket professional at Portsmouth Grammar School. It's Sam Lavery. Hello, Lavers. Any inspections for you this week?
None this week, but we are expecting inspections at some stage in the next few months. So any minute it could occur. So at the moment, we're in the clear, but maybe once they're done down there, they could be on their way to Portsmouth.
So let's talk a little bit about cricket. One thing I've been thinking about recently is that I've been working with some players in the off-season period, which is a time where we've really been doubling down on making some technical changes. And it's been, some people have been quicker than others to make those technical changes. And it started me to think about how much of a balance there is between those moments where someone gets it suddenly and those moments where it takes a long time and it happens more slowly. So in your experience, let's start with you, Gareth. In your experience, how often does something happen where somebody tries something a couple of times and bang, they've got it? And how often does it happen where it's a lot more slow and painstaking and step-by-step progress?
I'd say it happens less with the aha moment where it just happens very, very quickly. I'd say most of learning and most of learning that lasts with us for a long period of time is something that goes through the very usual process. When you start to learn something, it feels clunky and uncomfortable and horrible. And then part of the process is perseverance, really, and working through that horrible stage until it becomes slightly more efficient. And then eventually you end up mastering it. And what I find with those things is that those changes that people make often last the longest. They stand up to the more rigorous pressure rather than an aha moment is often as easily learnt and then easily given away. So it might not be something that lasts for a great deal of time. So that's been my experience. There have been a couple of exceptions to the rules on that one, but definitely if there is a rule, then probably the better way of going about it, in my opinion, is the slow and steady and having a bit of challenge and a bit of difficulty and finding a way to overcome that.
Often, Lavers, there's a perception that if you get the right coach, if you do the right piece of work and you get the right tip, then you can make a sudden and dramatic change as opposed to doing something in a slow and steady way and it being more painstaking and more difficult and more frustrating. How often do you see something that you say, it's a one-off comment, and then suddenly something happens that changes things for all time?
Yeah, I think the one-off comments and those aha moments probably occur more so in their thought process. So they have that sudden realization of what they want to do and sudden change of maybe perspective on things and outlook on how they're going to try and achieve something or how they're going to train. So it can have that immediate impact on how they're actually going to approach something or where they see themselves heading in the direction that they need to move in terms of their skill development or tactics or whatever it might be. But establishing them does generally take a long period of time. I think most guys probably do see that you get that immediate realization from a cognitive point of view. But it's not very often. And I'm trying to think of good examples now where it does happen immediately. And I'm sure there probably are a few. Trying to think across disciplines as well, whether is there anything that's been a constant sort of realization. But I don't think there are many. And I think it's probably down to individuals and circumstances combined and environment, which will suddenly allow someone to have that immediate physical gain. But a lot of them do benefit from that immediate mental progression when they suddenly gain awareness or understanding of what it is you're trying to achieve, but the physical side isn't quite so quick to follow.
In terms of the amount of time it takes Lavers, I guess the question how long does it take is the same as how long is a piece of string. It takes as long as it takes. But what is a sort of parameter for you? You know, what's a vague estimated time period it takes to make an average change?
Yeah, it's going to depend quite largely on the individual. So you're very right that it takes as long as it takes is a general rule that is always one you can probably sneak behind if you want to. Again, it's also going to depend on the significance of the change and how visible or how aware the bowler can be or the batter can be of that change within their actions. There are some things that are very easy for them to understand. So in terms of moving a front arm, for instance, it can be a visual thing because they can see the alignment of that front arm because it's in front of their face and they can get a direct awareness and get some direct feedback as to whether they're getting it right or whether they're getting it wrong. Where it's something else in the action, for instance, it could be something that isn't visible to them as they're doing it, which can take a little bit longer. Depending on what you're specifically working on, you'll find that some things will take longer than others. Individuals as well. I've seen a few guys who've tried to make some quite simple changes and they've really struggled with them. And it's taken kind of months on end, if not going into years, and they've ended up giving up on things which seem to be quite not simple changes, because I don't want to say that anything's easy, but not major things that you would expect to be complicated. Yeah, I've got other guys I've worked with, and I think of one good example at the moment of someone that Garrows will probably know, Mark Lawson, who Dave might know as well, who's used to be a leggy for Yorkshire, but he can run in and he can bowl leg spin, he can bowl Muralitharans, he can bowl. If you ask him to do it, he's given probably 15 minutes and he can kind of do it like to a reasonable level. He's got a really good awareness of his body with his bowling action, not with his batting. Some people don't seem to have that awareness and find life a lot more difficult. So, it is very much down to the individual and down to the process that they're looking to either block off or rebuild.
But let me press you a little bit in case someone is thinking, right, okay, I do want to make a technical change. I want to know how much time I need to give it. You know, if you don't want to be start, you know, you don't want to do it 2 weeks before the start of the season necessarily.
No, I would say if you've got regularity, so you've got a bit of consistency of practice. So you could give yourself 3 years. If you're only training once a month, you're probably going to find it quite difficult. But if you can get in once a week or twice a week, so it's something that's fresh and it's something that's continually being not only in your mind, but it's something your body is becoming aware of on a regular basis, then that's giving you a better chance. So the more often you do it, the more likely you are to see results. I would imagine with most people, you will see fairly significant progression. Once you've gone through probably somewhere between 8 and 12 sessions, you'll probably see a reasonable progression. And you're not going to see the finished article all the time. And sometimes you'll already be there. But I would have thought in that kind of time frame, you should see a pretty good progression. Again, we can then define how long a session is, how many balls we're bowling in that. I would have said that's a reasonable time scale to have some expectation.
Good. Okay. So that's giving some hope to people out there who want to make technical changes, want to change their bowling action, want to change their batting technique. That's, you have to think about how much time it's going to take you compared to when you're going to be in the competitive environment and playing games. Let's wrap up this section with a yes-no round. Three questions that you can only answer yes or no to, no matter how much more that the team want to say. I've got the question, so let's fire away. First question. Keep your elbow up.
No.
No.
Second question. Brush your ear with your arm.
No.
No.
Third question. Some people are naturals.
Yes.
Yeah.
At this time in the show, we dip into the mailbag and we pick out a couple of questions that have been sent in by listeners to the show or readers to the Pitch Vision website. And we do our very best to answer those questions to solve some problems for some of our listeners. And whether we manage to do that or not, we give the best question of the week a prize, which is an online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And that is exactly what Matt has done. And Matt's got quite a long question. Strap yourself in. He says, my question is around winter training and planning on what I might focus on. I was recently watching Kane Williamson and Ross Taylor batting together on TV, and it struck me that there was a contrast between them in where they contact the ball. Taylor is more active with his hands and seems more comfortable striking the ball further away from his body. Williamson seems happier taking the ball later and likes to let it get into his body more. Thinking about this contrast, I know I play a lot better when I contact the ball closer to my body. When I'm more active with my hands away from my body, it's normally a sign that I'm either nervous or overhitting and I tend to hit the ball uppishly. So what I'd like to develop is batting more positively, especially early in innings, but without going hard at the ball, and to prove the inconsistency of my power hitting. Is this a helpful observation about the way I like to hit the ball? And if so, how would you look to take these areas forward?
Well, it could be an indicator of the way you like to hit the ball, because you're going to be much better placed from all of your experience of being you hitting balls out in the middle in the nets to know exactly where your best contacts and most controlled contacts are made. So I would rarely disagree with a player that I was working out about where they believe. I would obviously get somebody to have a video of me from the side to have a look at my contact points and work it out for myself with a bit of evidence, and also marrying that up against my own experiences. So if you're telling us that you like to make contact more in line with a Kane Williamson from your observations of watching him bat, I assume you're talking about the test match at the Wacker where they batted together for a long time recently, would have given you a great insight into how both of them compare against each other. So if that's what you think, and I'm quite happy as a coach to go along with that. And I suppose in terms of controlling the ball, playing the ball late pretty much works for most people. There are a group of people that we've talked about before, and the likes of Joss Butler and the likes of Kevin Peterson would be people that fall into that category, who can make contact with the ball slightly in front of themselves and also control the way that that ball goes off a bat. Whereas other people, and myself included, if I ever made contact with a ball away from my body and in front of myself in the same way that those two did, then I would have no control and probably not a lot of power off the back of it as well. So, you know, you're in the most of us play the ball late. There are some people who need to play the ball really late. And when I say really late, I mean that letting the ball come all the way onto themselves in line with their tummy button almost, rather than underneath the line of the eyes, which is the generic thing that we hear from coaches all the way around the world. And it could be that Kane Williamson is one of those guys that needs to let the ball come right the way onto his body or in line with his body before he makes contact with it. And you could be as well. But you would know a lot more about that than myself. So in terms of being dominant, you can still be dominant early in your innings by playing the ball as late as you possibly can. It's just that you're probably going to get your body more in line with the ball. Those types of guys generally get themselves across their stumps a little bit and allow the ball to come all the way onto it, which opens up the leg side. And when they cut and when they back foot drive, the ball can beat backward point and on either side rather than necessarily going in front of square, but because they're making contact with the ball really late. You're probably a better position, certainly myself, to comment on your batting. I would always trust the batter because they know a lot more about themselves than us as coaches or observers would do. And yes, you can dominate, but you probably need to think about getting really in line with the ball so you can open up both sides to keep the scoreboard ticking over and open up scoring areas for yourself.
So, Lavis, does the way that you prefer to receive the ball in terms of your technique, does that change the way that perhaps you would play when you're trying to hit boundaries, you know, score fours and sixes maybe at the end of an innings?
Yeah, it's probably going to just change the options that suit you best. And if you think about players over the years and how they've batted, you can probably think about where their kind of trademark options are, that where they want to go. And there's some obvious ones when you think of guys who are offside cricketers. So, yeah, you think of a Matt Prior or a Sehwag and people that just create that little bit of space. And because of the way they like to receive the ball into them, they like to position their body in a certain way that allows them to really generate the power that their body can do in the way that's best suited to them. And as a result, they're very, very strong through that gully all the way around to kind of extra cover area. And they're very, very dominant through there. Whereas other people would be a lot more leg side dominant, and they're much more suited to getting the ball off their pads and over the leg side or straight over mid on or whatever it might be. So there's definitely a distinction between the two. I think that self-awareness and the more you can learn about yourself is really, really important, because you can find yourself looking to emulate a player who maybe isn't actually the same setup or the same approach to batting as you. Even though you may want to play a certain way, it may be that there are other options that are going to suit you better. So having that awareness of what does suit you, when you like to contact the ball, where you like to hit the ball, what position your body likes to be, and where you watch the ball best, all these kind of things, is going to be really really beneficial when you start building up your own kind of structure or game plan when it comes to striking the ball. It's a really good example here that he's compared himself to Kane Williamson, and he feels like they're in the similar mould, and he might be that he can use Kane Williamson's framework of where he attacks that might suit him as well along the way.
I remember, Gareth, that you, a while back, you posted an article about a way to kind of experiment with different ways of scoring by saying, you know, for this set, you have to try and hit the ball over extra cover or, you know, through square leg, or, you know, you define a scoring area and then the player experiments with lots of different ways of trying to do that and see which suits them. Do you think that would be suitable here for Matt to set a sort of a target zone and then go into the nets and try maybe three or four different ways of hitting it and see what comes out?
Yeah, I think even make it even more simple than that, David. If he sets an area that he wants to try and explore, but literally don't tell himself how he's going to do it, just have a go at seeing if he can hit that area. So it's a little bit like you got a wind blowing in your face when you play golf. Now, I'm a dreadful golfer, but I've got lots of friends that are good at it. But if you go out on a day where the wind's blowing in your face, you're faced with that, the intention of trying to get the ball up the fairway or towards the green, even though you've got this gale coming at you. So what do? You adjust a little bit and you hit the ball under the wind, don't you? You try and get your swing playing different to make the ball go, instead of going high, and going low. And all that is that you've got an intention of hitting the ball through the wind. Well, exactly the same when you practice. You can say, right, you know, today I'm going to try and hit a group of cones that's over extra cover. And you're not going to tell yourself how you're going to do that. You're just going to let your body adapt. And often you'll find that people will find their way of hitting that zone. In the same way, you could put another zone somewhere else and again find your way of hitting that zone. And what often happens is that coaches or us as players tell ourselves that we need to do it this way or we need to do it that way in order to hit that area, because it's based on what we know or what we've seen of other people do. And whilst that can be valuable at times, it can also be a derailer. So I would say put the intention out there, you need to hit this ball behind, or you need to hit as many balls as possible behind square, and then see what happens. So I do it a lot with the kids here at school. I say, right, you've got 10 balls on the Merlin. The only rule that I'm going to give you is that every ball has to go behind square. I don't tell them how they've got to do it. I don't tell them, you know, in what way they've got to do it. And they come up with their own options. And often they come up with really successful options, because what it does is it narrows the mind down to, here's my intention. What can I do to get a result for this intention, instead of having 550 different ways or theories or methods of trying to achieve success? So you tend to find that they do the one or two things over and over again, and they get very good at it. So I reckon it's a fantastic option for Matt. Pick out three areas. If you can hit straight down the ground, over extra cover, a mid-wicket on a consistent basis, if you do it standing on your head and spinning around three times, and you can do it all of the time, then I think anybody would be keen for you to play in their cricket team.
And it's a big challenge for a coach as well, isn't it, Labours, to say nothing while a player does that? Because instantly you start to think of things, oh, well, if he does this, if he positions his hands here, if he moves his foot there, you immediately start logging those things in your brain as possible ways to make technical improvements. You really need to give the player the space to work it out for themselves, don't you? And that's a real challenge, just to keep your mouth shut.
Absolutely. Bite your tongue and just try and hold back as long as you can, and let them just express themselves and find out what's going to suit them. And that learning is going to be all the more powerful if you can do that. Knowing when to jump back in is a really important skill, and learning when to give them that little bit of advice and help them along the way, but stepping back and also letting them go for the right amount of time and as long as they need to clarify things in their own mind and with their own bodies is also a really important thing.
Rick Charlesworth, who coached Australia to hockey success, is a brilliant cricket coach in his own right and just a fantastic leader, full stop. When he coaches people to do stuff like this, he, rather than saying nothing, because sometimes by saying nothing a player will be thinking, oh, I wonder what the coach is thinking, or I wonder what's going through his head, and then they'll sort of like fill in the gaps, and that will impact upon their game. If somebody's having a go at something, instead of saying nothing or giving them some advice, he will say, fair enough, if they have a go at something and it doesn't quite work, right? And then that fair enough is, oh, okay, well, I might be on the right track here, I'll keep going at that. And then they either choose to eliminate that as a method or to master it a bit more as a method. And then when they get it right, he says, good. Not what was good, he just says, good. And what some psychologists have worked out from a way that he's operated around building a new skill, as we're talking about with Matt and his power hitting, is that by saying fair enough doesn't make the player think that they're along the wrong track. It gives them the ownership of continuing to practice it. And then by saying good also doesn't mean to say that he's cracked it. So, you know, often I find myself saying, oh, that's brilliant, or that's awesome, and all that. That almost gives the impression that you've nailed it now. And the bottom line is that you haven't nailed it yet, because you need to do it over and over again and make that part of your game. In the same way, going back to Ross Taylor, but that sweep shot off of seamers that he whacks up over the top of the wicket, he's made very much his own way of doing things. You know, not everybody can do that, but he's practiced it enough to get it right. I bet when he first started doing it, he didn't nail every single one. But instead of getting beaten up by it, he probably had a bit of fair enough going through his head. And then when he started to nail it, it was good. It wasn't, I've cracked this completely. So your language as a coach can sit alongside that, but also as a player. You know, I used to get very excited if I hit one really well, and all of a sudden I was on top of the world. But the next one would come along and I'd nick it, and I'd be, you know, berating myself. And that isn't the way to go about it either. So be really realistic, Matt. Keep hitting those areas, and instead of judging yourself too much, then go between fair enough and good until you get to be able to do it 40 times on the bounce or 40 times out of 50, and then you can start getting a bit excited about it.
Next question is from Abhishek. Abhishek's a bowler, and he says, can you give me a few tips on how to drift the ball more? I'm a left-arm spinner, and I do drift the ball, but not much. I want to drift the ball a huge amount, so the batsman should fear my bowling. I have good dip in my bowling. Can we use the shine of the ball when we want to drift it?
Okay, well, drift's often just going to come down to number of revolutions we're generating on the ball, and also to a degree the direction of those revolutions. So you'll often find that if you can generate a lot of revs on that ball and you can get them going from, let me just get this right, you're a left arm spinner, so those revolutions are generally go from right to left, or from right to left with some overspin, then we're going to get that drift coming back in the opposite direction, hopefully. And that's what we're looking for, is the ball to drift in and then it's hopefully going to turn away. Now, it sounds like you're probably getting a really good amount of overspin on the ball, which is good as well. And as a finger spinner, that's often one of the more difficult things to achieve, is that overspin. So that's also going to be an addition to you. So first of all, I would always recommend to any spinner that they spend a hell of a lot of time away from the nets or in the nets or wherever it could be, just practicing developing that actual strength and power of those fingers and power of that snap from that wrist, so we can generate more spin. So there's lots of practice we can do, and hand-to-hand drills are a real big part of any spin bowling program to try and increase the number of revolutions we can get, but also try and be aware of the direction that those revolutions are pointing, because if we get them right, then we can find that not only are we doing well through the air, but we're also going to get really good reaction off the pitch as well. Whereas if we get them wrong, we might find that we're putting in a lot of work and we're getting really good reward in terms of number of revs, but we're not getting the outcome that we're looking for. Also, as a left arm spinner, you're going to have a really big advantage that you're going to turn, hopefully, the ball away from the majority of batters, but you'd like to think with a good amount of control and probably more than a wrist spinner, I would imagine. So you've got this already an added advantage of control, but combine that then with the angle that you're using. And this angle is a really good way to over-exaggerate the drift that you can be achieving. So if you can use your crease in addition, you can bowl from quite narrow and then from very wide as well. We can start getting the illusion of drift even when we're not getting it, or if we are getting drift, we can really get an over exaggerated level of drift. So there's probably a little bit more to it than just number of revs. You can also be smart about how you use it and how you apply it, using your position on the crease and using the way you're going to try, or the area you're going to try and land the ball in, given the conditions that you're bowling onto.
Does it make a difference, Gareth, if you've got a ball which is in good condition, shiny on one side and not so great on the other side?
Yeah, I was going to bring up ball condition because, the conventional thinking would be if you've got shiny ball, shiny side on one side, then it would be, just basic physics around swing, and that drift would act in a similar fashion. But a lot of the time when spinners bowl with balls, and especially in some of the conditions that a lot of our listeners play their cricket with him, the ball will come back to them in not the classic English conditions shape where you've got one shiny side and the other. And that's also an opportunity to get the ball to drift, because just in the same way as we try to create reverse swing or contrast swing by having a discrepancy between one side of a ball and the other, those little lifts of leather and those little bits of doming that you can shine, that little 50p or £2 coin or whatever denomination of coin that you've got in your country, as you can get on top of that cricket ball, will start to play around with the dynamics of the ball. And you could find that actually by creating that little dome that you'll get the ball to go against that, as opposed to in a normal way that we'd expect a shiny side to affect a ball. So the other thing to consider is shape of balls, because obviously a lot of us are playing cricket with one cricket ball over maybe 100 over game, because they're expensive things. They'll go out of shape a little bit. Again, that will affect the aerodynamics. So always experiment, and you can experiment not just by bowling the ball down the other end, but you can bowl it from one fielder to the other to see how that is making the ball go through the air. You can throw it from one fielder to other, trying to mimic the same release position as you would be for your left arm spin bowl in Abhishek, just to see how that ball is travelling through the air, because it could give you an indication of how you can then start to work the ball to make it more exaggerated, or how you can then start to use the natural components of that particular cricket ball to get the ball to drift through the air a little bit. So it's not a cut and shut case. And what I find is the best bowlers at looking after cricket balls inevitably come from the subcontinent. They invest more time in analysing what the ball is doing, what the characteristics of a ball, and they analyse to a point where they decide which side they're going to work on, which particular element of that side of a ball they're going to work on, and they watch to see what its reaction is. And as soon as it starts to go, whether it be a seamer or a spinner, they make sure that it goes through one pair of hands, that person has a responsibility to look after that cricket ball. And all of a sudden, whether it's a left-arm spinner like yourself or whether it's an opening bowler, things start to happen. So respect the ball, analyse it, look after it. The same things in the English conditions as you would have in the subcontinent. But I'd like a number of people to start doing a few of the things that people like Jai Surya are very good at. People like Rahul Dravid was very good at. People like Marcus Driscothic became very good at. It's a skill, and it helps not just the seam bowlers and the quick bowlers, but it also helps the spinners too.
This week on the Soapbox, Mark Garraway gets 1 minute to talk about anything he wants without any interruption from anybody else. So, Gareth, over to you for the Soapbox.
We've got the inspectors in this week, as I mentioned earlier, and it's been fascinating to look at what the inspectors want from us as teachers and coaches within this educational environment. And obviously all coaches are educators. I reckon I've run three of the better sessions that I've run in the last year or so as a result of actually putting together a plan. Now, often my plan sits within my head, and as a result, I get it right a few times out of 10, and that's grand. But I often found it difficult to translate my plan in my head across to people that are working alongside me in a coaching context, or even the players that I have. So we've actually written lesson plans for every lesson this week, because we need to show that to inspectors if they happen to come in. But we've decided as an environment and department to make sure that we keep doing that, maybe not to the same detail as we'll be doing this week, or other people around the school will be doing this week, but having some sort of plan that we can send out beforehand often helps the shape of a practice session when you're in it.
And that is the end of the show for another week. We are about to head off, but before we do, we're just going to decide on the winner of this week's competition. If you remember, we had two questions, and we need to decide who wins the online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So the two questions that we had were one from Matt about being more positive and fitting that in with the way that he plays, and one from Abby Shake about getting a bit more drift as a spin bowler. Which one did you prefer this week, Gareth?
I really like Matt's question. Fantastic detail. I love the comparison piece that he did on Williamson and Ross Taylor, because you're right, they are different in the way that they do it, but are world-class performers in their own right as well. I love the fact that you compared one of them to yourself. I'd always trust that, particularly, you know, without any footage, I'd always trust that. Maybe get some side-on footage to check and challenge your views of your contact areas. But hopefully we've given you a couple of ideas there. And certainly it's great that you're thinking about your cricket in that way, Matt. And I've got no doubt that you'll go well after doing all this work.
Congratulations, Matt. Well done. And that will be on its way to you. Of course, there'll be people listening to this show who aren't Matt, and they'll be wondering how they can win the prize and get their question answered. So, Gareth, how could they get in touch with the show?
They could give us a call on 0203 239 7543 or drop us an email on coach@pitchvision.com.
That's right. We have a social media presence as well. Our Twitter is at pitchvisionacad, and you can find us on Facebook by going to facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy, getting close to 70,000 people over there joining in the fun on the Facebook page. If you want to listen to the show every week, that's pretty easy to do as well. Get your favourite podcast app on your phone or your tablet or your computer. Do a search for Pitch Vision Academy. You will find us in there. Tap the subscribe button to get the show every week. There is also a webpage over at pitchvision.com/academy, where you can see all the old show notes, or you can download the MP3 file, or you can stream the show directly on the website. You can do all those exciting things very easily, and you just need to click on the podcast link when you go to the Pitch Vision Academy website there. That's all for this week. We hope you listen next week, but until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Lavers.
Cheers, all.
Thanks, guys.